From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, insurgents continue their push toward the Iraqi capital. Concerns about internet monitoring by the new Egyptian government. U.S. voters not always kind to presidential frontrunners, plus joy of the World Cup evading Sao Paulo shantytown. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Islamist militants from the Al-Qaeda-linked Islamic State of Iraq in the Levant have reportedly pushed to 100 kilometers north of the Iraqi capital, Baghdad. Edward Uranian is in the VOA Middle East Bureau with the story.
The government of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki had been seeking extraordinary powers to deal with militants from the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. But an urgent parliament session to impose a state of emergency was cancelled due to a lack of a quorum. Shiite Deputy Speaker of Parliament Khalid al-Attiya says the government will now go to the judiciary. He says that the government will seek the approval of Iraq's federal court for the state of emergency measures that it needs due to the current crisis. Prime Minister Maliki says it is imperative that Iraq's political class stop quarreling. He says that political leaders need to make an effort to unite rather than enter into sterile disputes. Everyone, he insists, must join together to help expel what he calls the invading criminals. Iraqi state TV showed lines of volunteers in front of military recruiting stations, although it appeared that turnout from Iraq's Shiite community was heavier than the Sunni turnout. Some analysts claim more than 90% of the Iraqi army is made up of Shiites.
وَازْحَفُوا إِلَى بَغْدَادَ الرَّشِيدِ بَغْدَادَ الْخِلَافَةِ فَلَنَا فِيهَا تَصْفِيَةُ
ISIL insists that its men plan to march on Baghdad. ISIL fighters reportedly took the oil refinery town of Beji and Saddam Hussein's hometown of Tikrit. Al Jazeera reported the ISIL was marching towards Samarra, home to one of the most venerated Shiite places of worship in Iraq. Iraqi planes and helicopters have reportedly bombed ISIL positions in a number of areas north of Baghdad. At the same time, Kurdish Peshmerga fighters captured the disputed oil town of Kirkuk from government forces, reportedly without a fight. The Kurds and the Iraqi government have locked horns in recent years over who should control the city. The director general of the Kurdish militia force, Jabir Yawar, told Iraqi satellite channels that government soldiers had abandoned 300,000 to 400,000 weapons and a number of planes when they withdrew from Iraq's second largest city of Mosul on Tuesday. The United States has indicated it is considering an Iraqi government request for military assistance to repel the invading militants. The ISIL says it wants to set up an Islamic caliphate in mostly Sunni regions of Iraq and Syria. Al Arabiya TV reported Thursday that ISIL has surrounded the Syrian desert town of Deir Zor, blocking all entrances and exits. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Islamist militant seizure of the Turkish consulate in the Iraqi city of Mosul is stoking concerns Ankara could intervene in that fast-spreading insurgency. Dorian Jones reporting now from Istanbul.
The radical Islamic group, the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant, is holding 49 Turkish diplomats and family members, including children, captive. An ISIL spokesman told an Iraqi Kurdish news organization that no harm will come to the diplomats. Turkish Foreign Minister Ahmet Davutoglu has warned of swift retaliation if the diplomats are harmed. Justice Minister Behi Bozdar says Turkey's government is considering whether it has sufficient legal powers to launch a military operation.
Bu konuyla ilgili her kurumuyla, her tür görevli ve yetkisiyle
The issue of whether the existing mandate is sufficient for a military operation or a new mandate is required is among the issues being discussed, he said. Cross-border military operations have to be sanctioned by the Turkish parliament. Last year, the parliament gave the government the power to launch military operations against Kurdish rebel bases in neighbouring Iraq. But the mandate expires in September. Analyst Cengiz Aktar of the Istanbul Policy Centre says Turkey may hold back.
Turkey's intervention could be justified in connection with the hostage taking at the Mosul consulate. But will Turkey dare to intervene militarily? There are serious doubts.
Adding to pressure on the government is the fate of more than 30 Turkish truck drivers, also being held by ISIL. Turkish media quoting one of the drivers as saying they are facing execution unless a ransom is paid. These seizures are posing difficult questions for the Turkish government about its regional foreign policy, says international relations expert Soli Özel of Istanbul's Kardahas University.
The fall of Mosul and then certainly the taking over of the consulate is basically declaring the bankruptcy of Turkey's foreign policy vis-a-vis the neighborhood. Because this organization is one that Turkey has at least indirectly nurtured, certainly tolerated, and gave logistical support to.
The Turkish media has been awash with reports of the presence of ISIL fighters in Turkey's border towns with Syria, along with pictures of ISIL fighters being treated in Turkish hospitals. Ankara strongly denies it's given any support to ISIL. Analyst Özel warns Turkey is vulnerable to retaliation if it moves against ISIL.
They probably have militants in Turkey. They probably have sympathizers in Turkey. And there are, I'm sure, plenty of Turkish fighters among them.
But Ankara has given signs of a recalibration of its regional foreign policy. Last month, it designated the radical Islamic group al-Nusra, also affiliated to al-Qaeda, as a terrorist group. On Monday, the Turkish and Iranian presidents committed their countries to cooperation against what they described as a threat of terror and radical extremism in the region. Observers say the latest events in Iraq may well expedite that cooperation, but it remains too early to say whether it will result in any meaningful action. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
And here in the U.S., President Obama says Iraq will need America's help to quell the Sunni militants that are threatening Baghdad after seizing other cities in the country. VOA's Michael Bowman reports now from Capitol Hill, where lawmakers of both parties expressed alarm over Iraq's rapidly deteriorating security situation.
Speaking at the White House, President Obama said he is reviewing how America can best assist Iraq.
Iraq's going to need more help. It's going to need more help from us, and it's going to need more help from the international community. So my team is working around the clock to identify how we can provide the most effective assistance to them. I don't rule out anything, because we do have a stake in making sure that these jihadists are not getting a permanent foothold in either Iraq or Syria, for that matter.
The president did not specify any options under consideration. On Capitol Hill, Republican House Speaker John Boehner accused Mr. Obama of dithering.
It's not like we haven't seen over the last 5 or 6 months these terrorists moving in, taking control of Western Iraq. Now they've taken control of Mosul. They're 100 miles from Baghdad. And what's the president doing? Taking a nap.
Senators of both parties emerged with grave expressions from a closed-door briefing by military and intelligence officials. Republican John McCain said the president and his team bear responsibility for the Iraqi crisis.
I think everybody in this national security team, including the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, ought to be replaced. It's a total failure. We are facing a disaster here.
Democratic Senator Joe Manchin said the United States has decisions to make regarding Iraq, but urged a toning down of rhetoric on Capitol Hill.
Playing politics with this right now is not a time to do that. This is very dangerous, and it's concerning for that whole region. I've always said this, if money or military might would have changed that part of the world, we'd have done it by now.
But Republican Senator Bob Corker said the United States cannot tolerate a situation he described as, quote, getting out of hand.
This continuing as it is certainly risk the entire region being just going up into flames.
Fellow Republican Senator Lindsey Graham urged U.S. airstrikes against Islamist Sunni militants. Democrat Carl Levin said there should be no rush to action.
We got to be very, very careful and thoughtful before we do anything and not knee-jerk anything, not to jump to any conclusions.
A Pentagon spokesman, Colonel Steve Warren, said the U.S. military is, quote, completely aware of the gravity of the situation in Iraq. The United States withdrew the last of its forces from Iraq in 2011. Michael Bowman, VOA News, the Capitol.
And you can keep up to date on what's happening in Iraq at our website, voanews.com. Still ahead, an apology from Egypt's new leader.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on the Voice of America.
Egypt's newly sworn-in president this week apologized in person to a woman who was sexually assaulted by a mob during last weekend's celebration marking his inauguration. State television showed Abdel Fattah el-Sisi with a bouquet of flowers visiting the woman in a Cairo hospital. El-Sisi said, "I came here today to tell you and to tell every Egyptian woman that I am sorry and I offer my apologies." Several women were assaulted during Sunday's inaugural festivities in Cairo's central Tahrir Square. These women were in the square on Sunday and said they didn't feel very safe.
I first came here at the end of 2010, so before the revolution, I say it wasn't as bad as it is now.
I always feel very uncomfortable walking around, and there is all forms of physical harassment that can happen to you and that happened to me before.
Journalist and women rights activist Hanya Mohib spoke with Sky TV, telling them she had been gang-raped in Tahrir Square during a demonstration in 2013. Tahrir, the birthplace of the 2011 uprising against Hosni Mubarak, is the most common site of such attacks amid the large crowds. Women's groups complain that tough new laws have not done enough. And speaking of new laws in Egypt, there are some who are concerned about the new government in Cairo and what might be an effort to control social media and the Internet. For more, we turn now to VOA's Ira Melman.
Egyptian civil rights activists are raising some alarms about a new government proposal that could vastly increase the online surveillance of Egyptian internet and social media users. Now, specifically, this proposal would scan the bulk of Egyptian web traffic, scanning for a variety of banned or controversial phrases and target the individuals using them. VOA's Doug Bernard covers internet freedom and privacy here at VOA. He joins me now. Doug, what's this all about?
Well, now, these are leaked documents from the Egyptian Ministry of the Interior that were first published about a week ago in the Al-Watan newspaper. Now, these documents detail a request by the Egyptian government. Technically, it's called a tender to international tech firms for software that can swallow up huge amounts of data from Egyptian users of, get this list, Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, LinkedIn, Instagram, WhatsApp, and Viber. And that is pretty much all of social media in Egypt. Now, before we go any further, about a day after publication, the Interior Ministry confirmed that these documents are legitimate.
Well, one could guess the answer to this, but let me ask it anyway. What's the government want to do with all this?
Well, here it comes. They want to vacuum it, I would
say. Vacuum?
Vacuum it. See, the government wants to purchase this high-tech software so they can scan through billions of bits of data for 26 specific words or phrases that the government says are associated with unrest or terrorism. Now, here are some of those terms, and I'm quoting from the document. Spreading vicious rumors, bad-mouthing, calls to reject societal norms, mobilizing demonstration, using bad words. So as you can see, or as you can tell, these are really rather vague. That's what's got free speech activists so concerned that the new government of President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi is planning a new crackdown on free expression online. Now, one activist we spoke with, Mohamed El-Messri, he's with Amnesty International, he said that giving this system to a, quote, unaccountable Ministry of Interior means that it will be abused to crack down on freedom of expression.
We have since the 3rd of July, we have seen crackdown on freedom of expression and assembly. And this system will give the Ministry of Interior a free rein to monitor those calling for protests or using the word defamation of religion, and will be might be arrested and face trumped up charges.
So got that, but other than civil rights groups, is there anyone else in Egypt speaking up against this whole thing?
Well, so far, no. No members of parliament have spoken up, nor the judiciary have criticized the proposal, even though there is some question as to whether it may violate the Egyptian constitution's right to privacy clause. Now, all that said, what seems clear, at least online, and to some degree in the population at large, is that there's growing concern about a new crackdown on expression in Egypt. We spoke with Sky News Middle East correspondent Shireen Tadros. She said, look, this is basically more of the same, and that it's clear, at least to journalists, that the government intends to control expression by any means at hand.
They will do what they need to do to make sure that everyone is on the same lines. And if that means further crackdown, I don't think they'll hesitate.
Finally, it's worth noting, I think, that everybody that we spoke with said the internet and social media in particular played a primary role in the first Egyptian revolution in 2011. That's the one that brought down then-President Hosni Mubarak. So we can't exactly be surprised that this government appears to be very focused on social media right now.
Well, we'll be following this story. You should, too. Listen to us on the radio, watch TV, and check voanews.com. With Doug Bernard, I'm Ira Melman, VOA News.
From the ordinary to the extraordinary, you never know what in the world will happen next.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its
military. You should not allow anyone to deprive you of your right to determine the future.
We are using this against terrorist groups coming from Turkey.
With a landing on
civilians. And sponsored by, no, we are not killing civilians.
With all that's happening, VOA News works to keep you up to date every hour of every day. So when you want to know what's new, you know what to do. Tune in your radio or click on the internet. World news on the hour, every hour, or at your convenience at voanews.com.
Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has embarked on a U.S. and Canadian tour promoting her latest book, Hard Choices, a memoir of her time as America's top diplomat. The book tour has fueled speculation that Clinton is likely to run for president in 2016 amid public opinion polls that show her as the clear favorite among possible Democratic and Republican contenders. But as VOA's national correspondent Jim Malone tells us, every frontrunner status, early ones, in presidential politics is not always a guarantee of success down the road.
Hillary Clinton is drawing large crowds on her book tour, and many Democratic supporters see it as an opportunity to urge her to run for the White House 2 years from now. Clinton says she'll decide on a White House run by early next year. Clinton's new book deals primarily with foreign policy issues during her tenure as Secretary of State. But during a recent policy speech in Washington, it was clear Clinton is also devoting considerable thought to domestic policy amid the speculation that she'll be a presidential candidate in 2016.
We know that America is strongest when prosperity and common purpose are broadly shared, when all our people believe they have the opportunity and, in fact, do to participate fully in our economy and our democracy.
Public opinion polls show Clinton is a huge favorite at the moment, both for the Democratic Party's presidential nomination and to the general election in 2016 as well. George Washington University political scientist John Sides says she appears to be one of the strongest political frontrunners in decades.
She's a known quantity to most voters.
I don't think she has to worry about image management yet. And ultimately, it's just a question of whether she thinks she has the necessary stamina and the desire to actually pull this off.
But Clinton has been in this position before. She was also a favorite for the Democratic nomination in 2008, but lost out in a lengthy and difficult campaign to then-Senator Barack Obama, who went on to become the nation's first African-American president. Democratic strategist Celinda Lake predicts that another Clinton campaign in 2016 would rally women voters who believe the time has come to make history again.
The vast majority of Americans said, we're going to have an African-American president before we have a woman president, and they were right. Well, now people think it's time for a woman. And there are a lot of particularly baby boomer women who feel like, if not Hillary, then who?
If Clinton does run, analyst John Side says she'll likely take a different approach to the race, given some of the tough lessons she learned in her losing campaign in 2008.
I mean, I think one of the things they learned is not to be caught unawares in some of these early primaries and caucuses. Barack Obama's victory in the first caucus, the Iowa caucus, was certainly a significant blow to her, and it really gave him the momentum he needed to carry this thing all the way through.
Voters have not always embraced presidential frontrunners. In 1972, Senator Edmund Muskie of Maine was the odds-on favorite to win the Democratic nomination. But he was upset by an insurgent campaign on behalf of South Dakota Senator George McGovern. McGovern went on to lose the presidential election in a landslide to President Richard Nixon. But elements of his campaign strategy were copied by other successful insurgent Democratic candidates over the years, including Jimmy Carter in 1976, Bill Clinton in 1992, and Barack Obama in 2008. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Brazil defeated Croatia 3-1 as the World Cup kicked off Thursday in Sao Paulo, Brazil's largest city. While the city focused on the game's residents of a local shantytown, also known as a favela, didn't feel like the party was theirs. Roger Wilkerson has our report.
Not far from these upscale buildings, kids in Moinho play soccer every day. Here, the noisy World Cup festivities do not carry much of an echo. With no toilets or running water, kids here learn early how to survive. In Moinho, there is no sign of the billions of dollars invested by the Brazilian government to organize the cup. Gerson Ribeiro lives in the favela.
I do not feel anything for this cup. Brazil spent money for the event, not for education. It's not fair. They invested billions of dollars for the World Cup, but nothing for health or education.
The few who have TV in their homes will watch the opening game between Brazil and Croatia. This cup is a real paradox for the people of Moinho, so close, yet so far away. The favela has been here for decades. The city of São Paulo wants to expel its residents from the site, but they fight back. Alessandra Cunha grew up in Moinho. Today, she works with kids to help them stay out of trouble.
There are people here who have needs, who have to be taken care of. It is not just a space. You have people living without water, electricity, or toilets. Some people don't even have a toilet inside their home right in downtown São Paulo, the biggest city in Latin America.
On the football field, kids keep playing. In this country where football is king, every kid dreams about being a professional and leaving poverty behind. Josuel Santana is 20. He still believes he can escape life in the favela.
To me, football is like a second life. Football is like marriage. I need to be faithful. I'll play anytime, anywhere. My knee hurts, but I never stop playing. I always dream about being a professional.
In the World Cup shadow, such dreams are priceless. To the beat of samba music, kids in Moinho always smile. It's worth all the trophies in the world. For French to Africa correspondent Nicolas Pinot, Roger Wilkerson, VOA News.
And some sad news. Actress Ruby Dee has died. It happened in New York. She was 91 years old. She was often partnered with her husband, the late actor Ossie Davis, on stage and movies and on TV. Couple on the front lines of the American Civil Rights Movement and were masters of ceremonies at the 1963 March on Washington, where their close friend Martin Luther King Jr. gave his legendary I Have a Dream speech. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you with us. A reminder, the top world news is coming up shortly. Hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jimmy Cook, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday.
This is Today in History. On June 13th in the year 323 BC, Alexander the Great, the young Macedonian military genius who forged an empire stretching from the eastern Mediterranean to India, died in Babylon, which is present-day Iraq, at the age of 33. Using military tactics that are still studied today, Alexander brought about sweeping political and economic changes based on ideas taught to him by the philosopher Aristotle. On this day in 1944, 1 week after the Allied invasion of France in World War II, the first of Germany's V-1 flying bombs was unleashed on London. A forerunner of today's cruise missiles, the unmanned V-1s struck indiscriminately, causing suspense and terror among the British public. On this day in 1966, the U.S. Supreme Court handed down the Miranda decision, which required a suspect in any crime be advised of his or her constitutional right to remain silent and the right to an attorney. The Miranda decision held that the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution required warnings before valid statements could be taken by the police. On this day in 1967, Thurgood Marshall was nominated to become the first black person ever to serve on the U.S. Supreme Court. On this day in 1971, the New York Times began publishing the Pentagon Papers, a classified study of America's involvement in Vietnam. The papers showed that the administration of Lyndon Johnson had lied to the public and to Congress about the war. In 2000, the first meeting between President Kim Jong-il of North Korea and President Kim Dae-jung of South Korea occurred. I'm Dave DeForest with Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Egypt's former military chief, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, was sworn in as president of Egypt June 8th, following his victory in the May presidential election. That election took place less than a year after the Egyptian military removed then-president Mohamed Morsi from office, after millions of Egyptians took to the streets, objecting to what they claimed was Mr. Morsi's increasingly authoritarian rule. The past year in Egypt has seen a crackdown on Mr. Morsi's supporters, particularly the Muslim Brotherhood, and arrests and detentions of many secular activists. In a statement, the White House said the United States looks forward to working with Abdel Fattah al-Sisi to advance our strategic partnership and the many interests shared by the United States and Egypt. The White House said that while it was pleased that international organizations were allowed to participate in the Egyptian elections, we also share concerns raised by observation groups about the restrictive political environment in which this election took place. In addition, the White House reiterated concerns about limits on freedom of peaceful assembly, association, and expression, and called upon the Egyptian government to ensure these freedoms as well as due process rights for all Egyptians. State Department Deputy Spokesperson Marie Harf said that the United States believes Egypt needs to continue its transition toward a stable, inclusive, and civilian-led democracy. Democracy is about more than just a ballot box, Ms. Harf said. It's about how you govern. It's about how inclusive you are. So we are going to be looking at all those things going forward. Egypt and its people have made clear their demands for dignity, justice, and political and economic opportunity, the White House said in its statement. The United States fully supports the democratic aspirations of the Egyptian people, and we will stand with them as they pursue the future that they deserve.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237 USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.